Welcome to God and Country Radio, where I discuss social, political, economic, and prophetic events in the light of biblical theology. I'm your host, Pastor Brad Winship, pastor of Harbor Bible Church in Central New Jersey. This week's program is session number 5 in a series called The Biblical Doctrines of Civil Government. For 13 weeks, I'm covering the historic Christian teaching in regard to government, the teaching that was the underpinning of the American experience. Anyone who has any expertise in political science should come to know the Christian theology of politics. It's where our founding fathers got most of their ideas. And as America departs from her Christian roots, it's no wonder that so many social leaders in America want to rebuild our state on the civil religion of atheistic Marxism rather than on the Christian civil religion of our founders. In session 1 of this series, I introduced the subject by explaining the prevalence and the importance of this doctrine in Scripture. In session 2, I discussed God's purpose in establishing government. In sessions 3 and 4, I covered the truth that nations are to be under God. In a sense, a theocracy, in that the moral law of the land needs to reflect the moral law of God. Not a theocracy in the false way that's being characterized by the left, but the theocracy envisioned by our founding fathers. Now, in this session, I would like to discuss what the Bible has to say about forms of government. God expects nations to be ruled according to the moral law of God, but that rule can be administered by a monarchy, or an oligarchy, or a republic, or a democracy. But before we discuss those forms of government, there is one form of government that God prohibits universally, and that is an empire. One of the first biblical texts in regard to the doctrines of civil government is Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. Verse 1. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. It came about as they journeyed east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used bricks for stone, and they used tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, otherwise we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, so they will not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building a city. So what's going on here, and why did God stop this project? The children's Sunday school version is that these ancient people wanted to build a tower to reach God's dwelling place in heaven. But no, they wanted to build a city that would serve as a capital for a one-world government. Because the elites didn't want people to be scattered. Because if they were scattered, they couldn't be controlled and taxed. The tower was a rallying point, a way to give the impression of authority. And we know how people do this today. They build edifices, they build theme parks, and people will pay to come and see it, and businesses will grow up around it. But God was not pleased with this agenda. Because chapter 11, verse 6, nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. In other words, they will be able to monopolize power. Who can stand against the power of a one-world government? There would be no competition to serve as a check. So that if the righteous are persecuted in this city, there would not be another city they could flee to. With the city of Babylon in control of everything, nobody could vote with their feet. Since mankind is by default sinful, the unified power of man will always result in injustice and oppression. Minority rights always need to be protected because the righteous are always in the minority. So as in American thought, there is a need for a division of power. Power corrupts, An absolute power corrupts absolutely. That is certainly not a belief taught in Marxism. So, God broke up their plan by reinforcing his prohibition against an empire with a little extra incentive. He divided up the languages according to family lines so that the people wouldn't get along so well. And this is where we get the Christian belief in nationalism. As we also see in Deuteronomy 32:8, God separated the sons of men. He set boundaries for the people. And in Acts 17:26, the Apostle Paul tells the Athenians, God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. It's man's greed for power that has resulted in empires throughout history, the Assyrian, the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, the Roman empires, where evil, unprincipled men steal lands given to other people groups, claiming that unity will be better for everyone, but God made sure those empires soon collapsed. In the Revelation at the end of this age, we see that the world will once again embrace a one-world government. This follows along with mankind's rebellion against God in the last days, and we should be aware that world leaders and the intelligentsia today are increasingly believing that a one-world government would solve all of our problems. So they're pushing for a borderless world and more control by the UN. Since these people are not looking to God, all they have to look to for deliverance is man and the combined power of man and government. That's why they're statists. But as we see in the Revelation, in this, they will walk right into a trap. The very thing they think will solve their problems will be their punishment. So God's plan for government is separate nations. And that is a Christian teaching, which is despised and criticized by atheistic systems. But as far as the nations themselves, which form of government is proper? A monarchy, an oligarchy, a democracy? One point in this lesson that is going to surprise most people is that the Bible makes allowance for each form of government based upon the situation. There is not one universal, perfect form of government that must be enforced on all nations. And here I want to again quote John Calvin's Treatise on Civil Government, written in 1560, because his work had the greatest influence on the Puritan mind in early America. And Calvin wrote the most complete work on this subject, and it best represents the position of all the Protestant reformers. Now, by the way, Martin Luther also wrote about the doctrines of civil government in two pamphlets. First, in 1520, entitled To the Christian Nobility of the German Nation Respecting the Reformation of the Christian Estate. And then a second pamphlet in 1522, entitled On Worldly Authority. And pretty much every theologian today recognizes that Luther was not as complete in his doctrine of civil government as Calvin. Luther was less organized, less clear. He dealt with his own local situation, whereas Calvin was a more careful theologian, writing a timeless textbook on the overall biblical teaching on civil government. So anyway, in Calvin's Treatise on Civil Government, section 8, Calvin writes that men often discuss which form of government polity is best. But the answer depends on circumstances. Monarchy is prone to tyranny. Aristocracy, a rule by an elite class, is prone to faction. And popular ascendancy, a democracy, has a strong tendency to sedition. But then Calvin goes on to explain that he believes the best form would be an aristocracy, a rule by a group of educated leaders, whether that be a pure aristocracy or one modified by popular government, the vote of the people. And what Calvin was referring to there was what we call a republic, where the people elect wise representatives to rule. And the reason Calvin gives for a republic being the best form of government is because it's so rare for kings to rule justly and wisely. Quote, "So because of the defects of men, it is safer and more tolerable for several to bear rule, that they may thus mutually assist, instruct, and admonish each other, and should any one be disposed to go too far, the others are censors and masters to curb his excess." Does this sound familiar? It's a concept of checks and balances in government put forth by our founding fathers. Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, number 10, sounds very much like Calvin in arguing for a representative republic. But then Calvin goes on to explain why an aristocracy is the best form, what we now call a republican form of government, because it's what God himself set up over Israel. Before the Israelites demanded a king in about 1000 BC, for the 400 years prior, God had the Israelites ruled by elders from each of the 12 tribes. The government was small and decentralized. And it's clear from 1 Samuel chapter 8 that when the elders of Israel demanded a monarchy, God deemed that to be a negative, a sin against God. Israel was supposed to be unique. Every other nation had a king, but Israel was to be ruled by God, Yahweh Elohim, a rule by God's law, not a rule by a human king. Because pagan nations didn't have the scriptures and the moral rule of the true God, they needed an authoritarian ruler to keep order. When the Constitutional Convention of 1787 ended, a woman asked Benjamin Franklin, "Dr. Franklin, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" Franklin replied, "A republic if you can keep it." Suggested in that reply is that a republic cannot be kept by every people group. And remember John Adams, what he said about our Constitution and our form of government, quote, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Well, the implied question is, what kind of government would be for an immoral and non-religious people? Proverbs chapter 28, verse 2. "By the transgression of the land, many are its princes." In other words, an unprincipled, immoral people need additional layers of government, more government control. So therefore, it would not be the best state of affairs for every people group to be under what we would call the best, the original form of government given to Israel. But this often confuses people. If in 1 Samuel chapter 8, the people sinned in wanting a monarchy, how could a monarchy be the right form of government for any people? And this is where theologians like to distinguish between the will of God and the perfect will of God. Romans 12:2. The will of God for the criminal, maybe for the criminal to go to jail, given his sinful condition. But the perfect will of God would be for that man to never be a criminal in the first place. But in that he is sinful, God makes allowances and concessions. He gets a different will of God. For example, the Israelites coming out of Egypt, was it the will of God that they would immediately go into the promised land, or was it the will of God that they first wander in the desert for 40 years? Well, the wilderness wanderings became the will of God for them, given their spiritual condition. So everyone's in the will of God. But are you in the perfect will of God for your full blessing, or are you in the will of God for your discipline or judgment? Now, this applies to forms of government. For a dysfunctional, unprincipled, godless people, God has allowed for monarchies. So let's look back at 1 Samuel chapter 8, where Israel makes this fatal transition from being an elder-ruled republic to a monarchy, a totalitarian state. There are many important lessons in this chapter that I wish more people could come to know. Chapter 8, verse 2, in order for the current republican government polity to work, the prophet Samuel is providing the necessary spiritual leadership. But in chapter 8, verse 3, The elders saw that Samuel's sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. So immediately, we see that there is a moral decline in the leadership, necessitating a change of government, not only to curb the corruption, but to punish the people. So the elders of the various tribes ask Samuel to set up a king for the nation. You know, a lot could be said here about why these elders wanted a king, given the fact that they would lose power. Maybe they assumed they could control a king, or a king would help moderate disagreements among the elders. But what usually happens in such cases is that civic leaders, in their moral ineptitude, are blinded to the unintended consequences. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 20, two reasons are given for why they wanted a king. First, that they may be like the other nations. And here we see they're turning to the world for counsel, not the word of God. They didn't understand the unique mission of Israel to represent God to this world, rather than being like the world. The second reason is quite alarming. They said that the king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Do you see the irony here? I believe the wording is meant to convey the foolishness of their request. Because kings don't fight your battles. They get you to fight the battle. And they sit on the throne. But here's a timeless principle. Irresponsible, unprincipled people want extra layers of government to fight their battles. Their education battles. Their healthcare battles. Their retirement battles. Their employment battles. And the deception is to think that government is there to do for you what God has called you to do for yourself. So the same reason the elders gave in 1 Samuel 8 for bigger government is the same reason people use in every generation. Now, even before their demand, Samuel explained to the people that a king, a totalitarian state, will be a negative. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 10 through 19. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. He said, "This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest, and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take of your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give them to his officers and to his servants. He will also take of your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you've chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, but there shall be a king over us.'" So, what was the problem of having a king? If you talk to socialists today, they would see this list of negatives as positives. After all, the king, the government, is creating jobs, organizing our labor. We can get all of our security in working for government. But what is the implied downside in Samuel's rebuke? The fruit of your labor is mostly going to the king and his administrators. And in political economic theory, big government is inefficient and costly because it always results in a leisure ruling class who make their living off of control. Always. Now, you would think at this point that the prophet Samuel would say, "No, you cannot have a king. It's a violation of God's will for Israel." But instead, God says to Samuel in 1 Samuel 8, 7, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. like all the deeds which they have done since the day I brought them up from the land of Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. So this request for a change in the form of government was a spiritual problem, not simply a political one. And they would get a king, and they would need a king, given their spiritual aptitude. So the story goes on. Samuel anoints Saul as king, and Saul helps Israel win a battle against the Ammonites. And as we usually see in the short term, a change toward big government always seems to bring temporary success. It meets an immediate need. But in chapter 12, God reminds the people that they have sinned in asking for a king. And so God wipes out their wheat harvest with a devastating storm. The people then acknowledge that they have sinned in asking for a king, but it's too late to turn back. And Samuel's reply to them is a guidance and a pattern for all Christian ministry toward unbiblical forms of government. For Samuel 12:20, Samuel said to the people, "Do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all of your heart. You must not turn aside, for then you will go after futile things, which cannot profit or deliver because they're futile. For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, but I will instruct you in the good and the right way." So Samuel gives the people the promise that if they obey and serve God, even in this bad system, it will go well for them. And earlier, Samuel told the people that if they were a righteous people serving God, so will be their king. The king, the government, will reflect the spiritual character of the people. So it's not like so many people assume that it's those evil politicians in Washington versus good citizens. If there are bad politicians in Washington, it's because the citizenship is also corrupt. That's why these people get elected. Now, as a Christian, you may see all this and want to throw up your hands and go off and live off the grid in the wilderness. But Samuel tells the people that even though they have made a sinful choice, he's still going to pray for the people and instruct them in the good and the right way. Here's a concluding principle to bear in mind. If a country becomes ungodly, do we allow for a totalitarian state? Because spiritually, the people may need it for discipline and judgment. No, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. On our part, we're always to instruct people in the best way. But at a certain point, if the system changes outside of our hand by people not listening to God, we accept the change of government as now the necessary will of God for the nation, and we still teach and preach and pray as always. As John Calvin wrote about the duty to preserve the form of government that best promotes liberty, quote, "Nay, even magistrates ought to do their utmost to prevent the liberty of which they have been appointed guardians from being impaired, far less violated. If in this they're sluggish or a little careful in protecting liberty, they are traitors to their office and their country." You've been listening to God and Country Radio. The website to listen to this program again, or to listen to the first four lessons in the doctrines of civil government, is the website godandcountryradio.org. Spell it out, godandcountryradio.org. The video version of this program is at the YouTube and Rumble channel, God and Country Biblical Exposition. Thanks for listening. Stand firm in the faith. May Jesus Christ reign.